and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the debate in the Senate today on the For the People Act, which was not a debate, because in order to have a debate in the United States Senate, you have to have a supermajority of 60 votes, and that is the mechanism by which the minority get to determine what bills are voted on, in effect giving Mitch McConnell control of the Senate agenda without having to lift a finger. This is the system of obstruction without cost that Senator Sinema and other Democrats defend in the name of bipartisanship, as meanwhile, the Republicans are getting away with rigging American democracy at the federal, state, and county level to ensure a white majority party will have one-party control over a multiracial majority into the future. Joining us is Alexander Kesar, a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. We will discuss our broken system of government, which is far from the perfect union the founding fathers had in mind, and what, beyond rhetoric, can the Democrats do to stop the steal underway based on the big lie of a disgraced president behind the recent coup attempt of a violent insurrection to overturn the will of the people. Then we'll explore further what strategies could be employed to prevent the Republican takeover of elections and the dismantling of American democracy, and speak with Charles Zeldin, a professor in the Department of Humanities and Politics at Southeastern University and the author of Bush v. Gore, Exposing the Hidden Crisis in American Democracy, the Supreme Court, and Elections. He joins us to discuss the new Freedom Riders heading out of the South to the nation's capital arriving on Saturday and the need for Biden to make saving American democracy a priority. Then finally, we will speak with Mark Fenster, a professor of law at the University of Florida and author of Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. He joins us to discuss the admission by the Biden White House today that we will not reach the 70% mark of Americans vaccinated for COVID by July the 4th, in part due to the influence of anti-vaccine conspiracy theories that claim the vaccines magnetize your body and contain microchips implanted by Bill Gates so that he can track billions around the world. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Alexander Kesar, who's a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, where his current research interests include election reform, the history of democracies, and the history of poverty. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and previously he chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections, and his latest book is Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Kesar.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to join you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Alexander. And today they're debating. Well, actually, they're not debating. This is the whole thing that I find so extraordinary about the Senate and about the state of our democracy. In fact, Senator Warnock made this plea today saying, at least let's get to the point where we can have a debate. So you can't even begin a debate in the Senate today on the For the People Act. So until you have a supermajority of 60 votes, and that's the mechanism by which the minority get to determine what bills are voted on, in effect giving Mitch McConnell control of the Senate agenda without having to lift a finger. That's surely not the system the Founding Fathers envisioned.
No, it absolutely is not the system that they could have imagined. I mean, there are many things about our our institutions today that they could not have imagined. But to the extent that they saw the Senate with a smaller number of senators and longer terms as being a place where there would be deliberation and debate, and where there would be room and perhaps the atmosphere for significant deliberation and debate, this is absolutely the contrary. I mean, the defense of the filibuster, the modern defense of the filibuster, on the grounds that it makes sure that minority views are heard and guarantees substantial debate, is simply wrong. It's not defensible at all. What happens with the modern version of the filibuster is that you can just say, well, you don't have 60 votes, so we are not going to talk about this on the Senate floor.
So in effect, what we have is a system of obstruction without cost.
Yes, exactly. That's right. I mean, when I refer to the modern system of filibuster, there was an earlier version of the filibuster. There were several different earlier versions, but in the one that I think is still in sort of popular imagination, where a member of the Senate, if he or she wanted to delay a vote and consideration, would take the floor and would speak for hours and hours and hours on end. And also, in so doing, often tie up the rest of the business of the Senate. So there would be costs for the senators who are filibustering, and there would be costs for the entire Senate. Now those costs are gone.
Well, meanwhile, though, the Republicans are rigging the system to essentially have a white minority party control our democracy, our multiracial majority in this country into the future, because they have a three-tiered system of overturning the Democratic conventions in this country, at least in the modern era. Firstly, through gerrymandering and voter suppression, in effect, in 2022, they could win the election, the midterm election, before any votes were cast. And then they, through partisan Republican legislatures, they then get to count and certify the vote. And then the other sort of part of this triad of electoral abuse and anti-democratic action is that there's a move underway financed by a lot of these plutocratic funders like the Koch brothers and the Judicial Crisis Network, etc., to have Republican partisans harass voting officials and poll workers to the point where a recent poll indicated half of the poll workers in this country feel threatened, many are quitting, and they're getting replaced by partisans who are similar to these people in Arizona that are conducting this bogus recount. So this is a concerted operation underway, and for the life of me, I don't understand why the Democrats don't have their hair on fire.
I wish I could point to your analysis and say where you were wrong, but I can't. And I think the question about the Democrats, I think that there are some Democrats who do have their hair or hairs on fire. I think that there are still a number who have some desire to return to regular order, who think that normal legislative means somehow or other can break the logjam. But I think there are some who are really, really deeply outraged. I mean, I think of statements from Bernie Sanders, for example. And, you know, but it's not just Bernie, and it's not just the left of the party. But they don't, but the Democratic Party, but it's not the entire Democratic Party. And so what the Democrats know, or what Democrats who are so deeply distressed about this know, is that they probably can't even muster a majority of their caucus to do anything much about it, including to alter the filibuster.
And again, I'm speaking with Alexander Kayser, who's a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, where his current research interests include election reform. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and he chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections, and his latest book is Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Well, just to be fair, Senator Schumer, the majority leader, in a speech today, did lambast the Republicans and describe what is happening as the worst kind of mendacity. And he kept pointing out that everything that the Republicans are doing at the federal, state, and local level is based on the big lie of Donald Trump. And that's been the justification for fixing something that's not broken. In fact, we had the most secure and successful election with the greatest participation in the history of American democracy in 2020, to the extent that the Attorney General, who was certainly a friend of Trump's, William Barr, said it was the best, you know, it's completely clean. But now, since then, they've created an alternative reality. So I guess the problem is that what's happening beyond rhetoric? It's great that Senator Schumer lambasted the Republicans because of the outrageous behavior at the moment and what they're planning on doing in 2022 and 2024. But practically, for example, the bill before the Senate today, the For the People Act, it obviously can be modified, but it has created a situation where the Democrats are divided against each other, and they're uniting the Republicans against it. And the Republican charge is that this is a power grab to federalize the elections. So my understanding is that the reason we have state elections is that the 13 colonies back at the time of the founding of the country, the first thing they wanted is to control their own elections. And that's the history of it. So is that charge that you're federalizing the elections accurate, or is it specious?
There's a bit of truth in it, but if you look at the long span of American history, which is what I get paid to do, what you see is a series of interventions by Congress itself, and through constitutional amendments to federalize aspects of the electoral process. I mean, that the 14th Amendment did that to some degree. The 15th Amendment, which banned discrimination based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude, it banned it in all states. That was federalizing. The 19th Amendment, which prevented discrimination based on sex, was federalizing. And there were a number of other measures in the 1960s. If on the one hand, the argument for state control is to permit those who are knowledgeable about conditions in the state to have control and to run elections. The logic of federalizing has always been to prevent discriminations which the states might get involved in depending on their own social structures and their own minorities. And the rationale for the 15th Amendment and the 19th Amendment and for the amendments in the 60s and for the Voting Rights Act was to say, we cannot just leave this in the hands of the states. Democracy is a national value. The right to vote is a national value, and it's up to the national government to defend and protect that value. Now, if it requires action by the national government to do that, as in some of the elements in the For the People Act, then so be it. I mean, you wouldn't have to do it if states were always well-behaved and non-discriminatory.
Well, we saw what happened with the Supreme Court's decision in 2013 to strip out Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. They immediately came up with laws in these states that were previously required pre-clearance in terms of a rash of voter suppression laws, which have now, of course, have gone to an astronomical level. Now, in terms of what Manchin is offering as a compromise, we still don't know whether you'd ever get to a vote on it, but still, right out of the gate, Stacey Abrams said she's absolutely on board. The idea of having a public holiday for elections, and the other aspects of it are to allow voter ID. The Democrats have always bristled at the idea of voter ID, but Stacey Abrams is arguing, no, we're in favor of voter IDs, but not ones that discriminate, like in Texas, where a state-issued student ID is not sufficient to vote, whereas a gun license is. So they're proposing reasonable forms of voter ID. So is there anything in the For the People Act that you see, Alexander, that could be categorized as a power grab or as federalizing the elections, particularly just focusing on Joe Manchin's bill, which is a more realistic approach?
Well, Manchin's bill is much less prone to the charge of federalizing elections because it reduces the dimensions of the For the People Act that focus on actual electoral processes, like how many days you can have and whether you can have absentee ballots and, you know, et cetera. But even Manchin's bill mandates that you have to have 15 days of early voting, and that's federalizing elections too. I mean, look, there, you know, in a sense, anything that Congress does in this terrain is federalizing. It is saying that we must have relatively uniform rules and procedures because this is a democratic country. In that sense, I think that the federalizing charges are really largely specious. I agree with Stacey Abrams. I think that that Manchin's bill, although parts of it are not very well spelled out yet, but I think that Manchin's bill is workable. And I think that the political strategy of the Democrats has been to bring up the For the People Act in its original form, which is what was introduced in the Senate after being passed by the House, to bring that up and then begin a process of dialogue, which I think will be largely among themselves now, about what changes to it could be made. And I think those will focus around the Manchin version, and then they will try to bring that forward. And then when that doesn't get anywhere either, and I don't think it will, perhaps the notion is that could lead to a unified Democratic caucus to change the filibuster. But I wouldn't bet the ranch on that strategy.
But what you're describing is certainly not a particularly winning strategy on the part of the Democrats to end up divided and debating amongst themselves when the real object should be to force Mitch McConnell and the obstructionist Republicans to defend their position.
Well, they're having a hard time finding a way to do that. I mean, it's I've wondered, for example, and I may get in trouble for saying this. I wonder whether one, move that they might make would be to threaten to do extreme partisan gerrymandering in states that the Democrats control, saying if you're going to do this kind of stuff, we're going to do it back to you, and see how Mitch McConnell takes that or absorbs that.
Well, so far there's been no cost for what the Republicans are doing, both in terms of the filibuster, where the minority, it becomes the tyranny of the minority. They get control the Senate's agenda, and it's preventing debate as opposed to encouraging it, and that's obvious. So all that blather about bipartisanship is ridiculous because, as it's made clear, that you can't even have a debate unless you got 60 votes. And then you've got all these voter suppression and rules changing happening at the states and local levels as well. That so far has been cost-free. So I know I asked you about the Democrats should have their hair on fire, but in a practical sense, is there anything that can be done to stop this juggernaut? And as I mentioned earlier, it's a kind of a three-pronged juggernaut: gerrymandering and voter suppression up until voting day, and then after voting day, they get partisan Republicans get to count and certify the vote, and all the while there's an effort underway to drive out neutral poll workers and put in partisan, QAnon types that are active now in this bogus recount in Arizona.
You know, I'm not sure that there is a further way for Schumer and the Democrats to play hardball. I mean, there are, you know, I think that in a sense, you know, what they are also saying to themselves and what I read them saying, you know, is that the For the People Act, or a lot of the propositions in the For the People Act, are widely popular in the population among Republicans as well as Democrats. And that if the Republicans continue this, then they will try to run against them in 2022 on that. That's a longer term strategy. And I'm not sure also that it's a winning strategy. You know, I don't know what moves they could make. I mean, I've been imagining other things which are more rhetorical, but again, trying to back the Republicans into a corner. For example, bringing up again the notion that has been brought up from time to time in the United States, but a simple proposition to add a right to vote to the U.S. Constitution and see if the Republicans want to oppose that publicly.
Well, that's not a bad idea, actually, Alexander. I mean, the long and the short of it is, just in closing, that what's happening now to the GOP, the Republican Party, it's almost like they're borrowing from Joseph Stalin, who infamously said, it doesn't matter who votes, it matters who counts the vote.
That's absolutely right. I mean, their behavior is not the behavior, you know, this is not regular partisan politics, so to speak, and it's not the behavior of a party that believes in democracy and that takes a longer run stance, you know, that says we'll win some elections, we'll lose some. If we lose, then we regroup and we go back and we fight again. And that what that may betray, what that may suggest, their inability to take this conventional longer run stance, may betray a sense of panic that they have, that the demographics are against them, and that if they can't build up minority rule now, they will never have the chance to do it.
Well, Alexander Kayser, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure, Ian. It's not a pleasure. It's a grim subject, but it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you. And I couldn't agree more. And I've been speaking with Alexander Kayser, who's a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, where his current research interests include election reform, the history of democracies, and the history of poverty. His book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and he previously chaired the Social Science Research Council's National Research Commission on Voting and Elections. And his latest book is Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? We're going to take a brief station break and be back exploring further what strategies could be employed to prevent the Republican takeover of elections and the dismantling of American democracy.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Charles Zeldin, who's a professor in the Department of Humanities and Politics at Nova Southeastern University's Hulmos College of Arts and Sciences in Florida, an expert on voting rights. His books include Voting Rights on Trial, The Battle for the Black Ballot, Smith v. Allwright, and The Defeat of the Texas All-White Primary, Bush v. Gore, Exposing the Hidden Crisis in American Democracy, and The Supreme Court and Elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Zeldin.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Charles, there is a new version of the Freedom Riders, a convoy of buses. On Monday, they were at Martin Luther King's Ebenezer Baptist Church. Today, Tuesday, there will be in South Carolina. And then on Thursday, they'll be in West Virginia, I guess, to somehow rattle Joe Manchin's cage. And then on Saturday, they'll be in Washington, D.C. So if you look at the electoral landscape that the Republicans are now trying to re-engineer, making themselves, in fact, a one-party state, a permanent majority, it's clear that they would rather cheat than compete. and through gerrymandering and voter suppression, they get one bite of the apple on voting day by suppressing the vote. And in fact, arguably, even before one vote is cast in 2022, they will win. And then they get another bite of the apple through Republican legislatures that have rigged the system so that partisan Republicans get to count and certify the vote. And then and another layer of this mendacity is that there's this war on people that work at the polls, the normally neutral poll workers. They're being harassed and intimidated. Half of them feel that they're being threatened, and many, many are quitting, and they're getting replaced by these kind of crazy people that are doing this bogus recount in Arizona. So that's the landscape we have at the moment, and it's obviously going to get worse. So I guess my question to you, Charles, is shouldn't the Democrats basically just say, okay, what you guys are doing, you, the Republicans, are doing is you just want to have a country in which only white people get to vote, and minorities, too bad, you're out of luck.
Well, the problem with that is that the Democrats also need white voters, and there's a possibility of alienating some of those white voters if they take that line. So instead, what they're arguing is that the Republicans are trying to reinstitute Jim Crow, one-party rule, political system, a electoral system that is gerrymandered, that is manipulated, that is, in some cases, backed by violence as a way to maintain power, as opposed to, like, doing what the people want. And so, in a sense, they are arguing that, but without coming out explicitly and saying, you're trying to create a white-only political system.
Well, today, of course, the Democrats are voting. We're not quite sure when the vote will be taken finally, but at this point, we know that Chuck Schumer had a meeting with Joe Manchin, and Joe Manchin's agreed to vote with the Democrats, and they certainly need to get all 50 Democrats to vote. Obviously, getting to the 60 threshold, it will be impossible, and that's what this whole problem is with the Senate. So given that this is what's going on today, it's been billed as the big battle. Frankly, I'm wondering what kind of a battle it is, because this battle has divided the Democrats and united the Republicans. The opposite tactic presumably would have been better.
Well, in a sense, this really is not a battle. This is a skirmish. All this is a vote to decide on whether they will publicly debate the issue in the well of the Senate. In other words, will they go on and have a debate prior to actually voting on the topic? So there's no substance here. It's all procedure. And the thing that the Democrats knew going into this is that they probably were never going to get 10 Republican votes in favor of this bill. What they were hoping for was that they'd at least get 10 votes in favor of debating the bill, and then later on let the votes fall as they may. But for the Republicans, they just simply want this to go away, because for all the hyperbole and self-serving nature of the arguments Republicans have made in arguing against this, one thing that Mitch McConnell has said is very true. The impact of this bill will be to help Democratic voters be able to more likely vote, in the same way that the impact of the bills that are being passed by Republican state legislatures are making it harder for those same voters to vote. So for the Republicans, they don't want these voters to vote. They don't want to debate it. They just want the issue to go away. So for the Democrats, this was never going to be about winning it at this point. What they're trying to do here is put pressure on Manchin and Sinema to be willing to modify the filibuster, to realize that what they want, which is bipartisanship, simply can't happen in this environment, and therefore to be open to some form of change that would then allow the possibility for this bill to go. I fully expect that you're going to get 50 votes from the Democrats in favor of going to debate. that's not really a big dilemma for them. The question is, when the filibuster gets kicked in because they don't get those 10 Republican votes, what do you do next? And that's where you've got most of the caucus in favor of changing the rules, but at least these two senators who are not sure that's a good idea yet. And this is all about convincing them to change the rules for the filibuster, because that's the only way this bill is ever going to pass.
Well, Kyrsten Sinema had an op-ed, of course, in the Washington Post. We have more to lose than gain by ending the filibuster. And it didn't seem to address the central question. Is it? It's true. Theoretically, the filibuster protects minority rights. But since McConnell's been in there in the last couple of decades, it's been used as a basically a tool to obstruct. And it's an incredibly easy tool. I mean, there's no skin in the game. They just phone in a filibuster, and you've set a bar of 60, meaning you've got to have a supermajority to pass anything. So this is literally the tyranny of the minority. This is the reality, isn't it? The tyranny of the minority.
Very much so. This is not the filibuster that Sinema is thinking it is. That's the filibuster of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, of where you had to go into the Senate and you had to debate and argue, and you locked up the Senate by arguing your case against the majority. As currently operated, all the minority has to do is say, we don't want it. And boom, it can't happen. And that's the problem. So the one possible solution is go back to the old filibuster. Make everyone debate. You wanna filibuster this? Then you've got to take control of the floor of the Senate, and you have to keep it, which means you've got to keep enough of your caucus in there so that if there's ever a chance, a vote called to challenge the filibuster, you still can win it. You still have those 40 votes, those 41 votes. And these are the arguments being made to Sinema and to Manchin about you can modify the filibuster without getting rid of the filibuster. Now, there are Democrats who want to just get rid of it. They're tired of a system in which the minority can basically be in charge. And keep in mind, when they're in the minority, the Republicans don't want to do very much that isn't fiscal, and we've already gotten rid of the filibuster for fiscal matters with reconciliation. So there's really not a lot of pressure on Republicans of wanting to get things done that Democrats can shut down. So, yeah, I mean, this is part of the education process. Note, the Freedom Riders that you're talking about, historically, the original Freedom Riders, started in Washington, D.C., and then they moved into the South. Today, they're starting in the South, and they're moving to Washington, D.C. It says something about where the center of the fight is now.
So given that this is the new, I mean, the Democrats, of course, most of the filibusters took place by the Democrats during the 60s against voting rights and against civil rights. And that's when you had the Dixiecrats in the Democratic Party. And then once, in fact, Lyndon Johnson said when he signed the Voting Rights Act in 1965, he said, well, you know, the Democrats are going to lose the South. Well, they did. And now the Republicans are the Southern Party. So is that what you're sort of referring to in a way, that this is a different South?
Well, what we're seeing here is that the parties are different. The Democrats of yore are the Republicans of today. They were the ones who were fighting all this, but what happened is the Democrats of the South became the Republicans of today. And so the Republicans of today share those roots in segregation and in Jim Crow. And they are, in essence, trying to recreate that system today.
Well, there is a lot of chicanery going on in the South with the Republican governors and in Republican-controlled legislatures. I mean, they're purging voters off the rolls in Georgia in huge numbers. And remember, Stacey Abrams lost to Governor Kemp, the current governor, by, I think, only about 100,000 votes. And he had managed to purge at least 100,000 votes from the rolls before that took place. So,
actually, it was a 500,000 votes that he managed to purge back then. Even more important is what's going on with this effort to drive out the people who run our elections. The secret of Jim Crow was that it put into place people who ran the election, supervisors, whose primary goal was to exclude unwanted voters, black voters primarily. And they manipulated things at the local level to produce results that they wanted. This was the unspoken weapon of Jim Crow, was the control of local election boards and local supervisors of elections and what have you. And potentially that's happening again in the South, and that's dangerous because those sort of manipulations are hard to find and control sometimes. You know, it's hard to see what they're doing because it's a process that in my book on Bush v. Gore I described as administrative gerrymandering the rules by which you run the election. And that's problematic. So there's a lot that's going on in the South right now that's scary. And this bill, the For the People bill, is an attempt on a federal level to counteract those changes, which is why the Democrats feel they need absolutely to get this passed.
Well, but it's already, Manchin has suggested changes to it, and these are the changes that Stacey Abrams actually approves of. She absolutely approves of it. So
yeah,
it can be modified, surely.
Oh, of course. It's open to modification. There are things in the bill that are kind of wish lists for the Democrats. Everything they want to do to fix the voting. Well, that would be great if you could get it. But in this environment, maybe what you need to do is focus on the parts that you absolutely have to fix to keep the voting system honest. And that's really what Manchin's proposal was getting at, ways in which you could achieve that. And as a result, the Democrats pretty much in lockstep, progressives as well as moderates, simply said, okay, we like your idea. Let's see if the Republicans will vote for that. And of course, today we're going to see that they're probably going to vote not against it. You know, they're not going to accept this idea. And that puts pressure on Manchin now to be open to the idea of changing the rules of debate, of the filibuster, in some manner that would allow the Democrats to pass his proposed amended bill.
Well, just in closing, though, some of the former Republicans, particularly the Lincoln Project, people like Steve Schmidt, what they're saying now is that just forget about the Republican Party. It is not the Republican Party of your father or grandfather. In fact, Matthew Dowd, another prominent Republican operative, he said that you have to think about the Republicans as black mold that's taking over your house. And it'll kill you and kill your house. So you have to just get it out, and it'll take a while. But the house itself is rotten and uninhabitable. So that's what you're hearing from traditional Republicans about their own party. On the other side, what you're hearing from the liberals, like the indivisible people, are a kind of plea to Joe Biden saying, you know, enough with the vaccines and everything else that you're doing. Surely the number one priority that you should be facing, President Biden, is you have to rescue American democracy because American democracy itself is under attack. Where would you come down on the latter in terms of messaging?
Well, they need both, actually. They need the vaccines to basically say government can do its job, that government can do good. Vote for government, vote for Democrats. But at the same time, if they allow the Republicans to warp the electoral system, I mean, this isn't just a one election cycle problem. This is a multi-election cycle problem. So I think I fall on the side of those who are saying it's time to take on this situation. And what that will mean ultimately is that the Democrats are going to have to be open to changing the rules of the Senate, because there's no way otherwise they can get these sort of bills passed.
Well, Charles Eldon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I mean, speaking with Charles Eldon, who's a professor in the Department of Humanities and Politics at Nova Southeastern University's Halmos College of Arts and Sciences in Florida, an expert on voting rights. His books include Voting Rights on Trial, The Battle for the Black Ballot, Smith v. Allwright and the Defeat of the Texas All-White Primary, Bush v. Gore, Exposing the Hidden Crisis in American Democracy, the Supreme Court, and Elections. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the admission by the Biden White House today that we will not reach the 70% mark of Americans vaccinated for COVID by July the 4th.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Fenster, who's a professor at the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida, whose research focuses on government transparency, legal intellectual history, and constitutional limits on government regulation. He is the author of The Transparency Fix, Secrets, Leaks, and Uncontrollable Government Information, and Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Fenster.
Thanks, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the Biden administration had to admit today that it won't reach its July the 4th target of vaccinating 70% of the American people with at least one vaccine. The problems are in some of the southern states. There's only about 50% of people being vaccinated. So, and the young are not being vaccinated at the rates that are necessary. So, given that they are falling short of their target of 180 million Americans vaccinated by July the 4th, they're roughly going to have about 175 million adults vaccinated by that target. So that's 5 million short. Could you attribute that 5 million who haven't been vaccinated to these conspiracy theories swirling around that have created the anti-vaxxer movement?
I'm sure that some of them are. I think there's no way of tracing precisely why it is people are choosing not to get vaccinated. There are no doubt some people who have extremely strong versions of their distaste for vaccination, particularly this vaccination. But, you know, vaccine hesitation is not limited only to folks who are opposed to the Biden administration or who are skeptical of COVID or other things like that. It long predates not only COVID, but you know, the sort of contemporary era. We've long had people in the U.S. who, for a variety of reasons, some of them religious, some of them ideological, some of them just personal, are hesitant to and resistant to taking a vaccine.
Well, according to a poll done in May, the YouGov poll, they found that at least half of the people who say they won't get vaccinated believe at least one conspiracy theory about the COVID-19 vaccine or vaccines in general. So that's a lot, half of the people polled. So I should...
Right. Although you never know what is precisely driving, whether the conspiracy theory is driving their hesitation to get vaccinated or whether their hesitation to get vaccinated is driving their willingness to say in a poll that they believe in a conspiracy theory. So, I mean, it's a subtle difference, but I think it's an important one. To be clear, I have been vaccinated. I love the vaccine. Extremely thankful for all those who both worked for and made the decision to push for the development of vaccine. But, you know, there are lots of different reasons why people are hesitant to take vaccines. And some of them are an often overbroad and extreme, but still healthy skepticism of the sort of medical industrial complex. And I don't think that this is a vaccine for which that fear is well taken, but the skepticism about our healthcare system and about the way in which it's administered by private identities is not necessarily one that I would absolutely brand a conspiracy theory. It is the sort of good kind of democratic bottom-up skepticism that I think folks on the left and, you know, folks on the right actually can share sometimes.
Well, obviously the J&J vaccine that was held up briefly because there were a very, very small number of people who had blood clots. And I think, at least to my mind, that would indicate that they're being careful.
Oh, absolutely.
But it did have the opposite effect. It fed the anti-vaccine movement.
Right. No, and I think that globally is true, too, with the AstraZeneca vaccine and hesitancy in other countries to take up a vaccine that whose rollout has been sort of butchered and whose and particularly where national systems are not doing a particularly good job of persuading the public that these vaccines have been well tested. I mean, we're in a, you know, if you think of just how unbelievably quickly this vaccine was developed and the kind of technological changes that and developments that this represents, you know, it's just unbelievably fast how this came out. If you think of how long so many drugs that people are dependent upon, you know, if you think of HIV/AIDS, for example, the extended length of time that it took and the fights with the FDA that ACT UP and others had with the slow rollout of drugs where the FDA was being really careful. You know, again, I don't agree with it, but one can understand some concern about, well, this came along really quickly. That is, it is reflective of a sort of modern world and and technological developments that are, you know, incredible. And again, I took the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and I'm extremely happy to have it. I think we have a... I think it's going to be that much more difficult to persuade people who are hesitant now if we call them conspiracy theorists. I think there are no doubt some people who will never be persuaded and who will always, you know, for however long the vaccine or that we're going to have these vaccines, will always be hesitant to take them. But there are, I think, a lot of people, and probably more than half the people who have thus far refused to take the vaccine, who are persuadable, who might have heard some things, who might have certain sort of folk wisdom that has them resist the vaccine, but who could be persuaded. It's just finding the right message and finding the right messenger to allow them to sort of come to terms with the fact that this vaccine will not harm them if they take it and will only help them. So that's my feeling about the conspiracy theory element to this. There are people who believe in conspiracy theories, and that's what's leading them to do this. There are other people who will sort of agree with conspiracy theories for ideological reasons or other sort of folk wisdom reasons, but who might actually be persuadable. And I think just calling them conspiracy theorists raises a real risk of losing them entirely.
So, what then do you think, Mark, of these efforts underway by various states to incentivize people to get vaccinated with lotteries, winning $1 million, you know, sweepstakes, win a Cadillac, I mean, that kind of stuff?
It's fun. I think that, you know, it adds a certain game quality to the effort. I'm not sure how successful they'll be. I mean, they'll be marginally successful. It will lead some more people to get vaccinated more quickly than they otherwise would have. But I think the problem, as I said, is the question of what is the best message to provide to people. But it's not just the best message. I mean, there's a lot of very good ways and to me quite persuasive ways of explaining why it is that people should take up the vaccine. But the problem is figuring out the right messenger in a world in which everything is so incredibly polarized. It's why it's so disappointing, for example, that the governor in my state in Florida, who is a, you know, Republican, a potential presidential candidate, got vaccinated but refused to have television cameras capture him getting vaccinated so that he would have some plausible denial deniability as to whether he was vaccinated. And the same with Trump. And one wishes that more leaders of the Republican Party would be willing to really sort of powerfully try to persuade voters, as well as, you know, Fox News personalities and other folks, to persuade their followers, their viewers, et cetera, that taking a vaccine is the right decision for themselves and the right decision for the country.
Well, when you talk about polarization, it is pretty hard to believe that somebody like Dr. Fauci could be so vilified and hated, right, and under threat of death. I mean,
right,
you know, he seems like a really nice person, and he's yeah, nobody's ever said he's not qualified. And
no, and I mean, I think, you know, the back in the HIV crisis during the Reagan administration, after resisting the calls to speed up the approval of drugs, or at least the emergency approval of drugs, and letting people take experimental drugs, he ended up understanding. I mean, he bent some of the existing rules of public health and of infectious disease regulation to recognize the importance of speeding things up. And so, you know, he has remarkable credibility as a public health official.
So I take your point, Mark Fenster, that it's counterproductive to make fun of or ostracize anti-vaxxers. And the challenge is to find a way to educate. And you feel that at least maybe half of the people not taking vaccines because of they believe that there's some problem with them, they're, half of those people are reachable. Now, I think a lot of the fact that only 50% have been vaccinated in most of the southern states, that must be a different issue there. Is that sort of poverty, lack of information, lack of infrastructure? How would you describe that fact?
Oh, well, it's quite possible. I mean, I don't, this is not my field. In my state, in Florida, in part because of our elderly population, and the fact that we're not, you know, we are partially a southern state, but a very complicated southern state in the same way that California is not simply a western state. There's a lot more going on in California than merely the West. You know, we've had good take up rates, even among Republicans, particularly because senior citizens have gotten vaccinated at remarkably good rates. So clearly, there's probably, you know, some degree of educational level, some degree of, as you mentioned, public health infrastructure, some degree of resistance. And, you know, let's understand, too, the fact that people of color were disproportionately affected by COVID and have also been historically disproportionately affected by poor public health servicing. And there's hesitancy among those populations as well. And, you know, those populations are, especially in certain parts of the South, very large percentages of the public.
Well, the coverage is highest amongst those 65 and older. That's 80% mm-hmm. coverage.
Right.
The lowest is among those 18 to 29-year-olds. That's only at 38.3. Right. So right. What do you think that's about? I know, again, it's not necessarily your expertise, but my guess would be that the young feel invincible. Is that what it is?
I think that's fair to say. I mean, I do teach in a college town, and you know, it was clear even in the midst of the sort of pre-vaccine pandemic that folks in their 20s were just not taking it as seriously. And I think the idea there, I think from their perspective, was both, you know, I am a young person, and at the time, you know, the pre-vaccine, it's like, I'm going to live my life because I don't want to give up a year of my life for a disease that's not going to kill me. And so there's some degree of being like, well, the risks aren't that high, and so I'm going to go ahead and live my life as it is. And, you know, a certain degree of selfishness as well, that, you know, since the risks are not high, I'm not going to get the vaccine because I'm, you know, I've heard rumors about it's going to affect my, you know, reproductive capability and other things like that. So, I mean, I think somewhat it's a lack of education, somewhat it is selfishness, a whole bunch of other things that are going on there. I mean, I think to the extent that, and again, I live in a state where my governor is barring universities from requiring it. But to the extent that private universities or some state universities are going to require as a condition of enrollment in the fall, require vaccination, that will be helpful. So some degree of mandate would be helpful with populations like that.
Well, but I think you can point to Fox News and there's other even more right-wing disinformation platforms like ONA and Newsmax for beating the drum on all these conspiracies, because they went completely ballistic over what they dubbed as vaccine passports. There was no such thing offered, but they were in hysterical mode over it. I just noticed, for example, the first rock concert that's happened since COVID took place at Madison Square Garden a couple of nights ago with the Foo Fighters, and everybody that got into the Madison Square Garden had to show proof of vaccination. So what's the big deal?
Nothing. No, I went to a an NBA playoff game and I had to show proof of vaccination before I got in the arena. So it's not. But once it becomes ideological, then there is a real resistance to anything that's going to require an act of some sort that people are going to resist, whether for good reasons or for symbolic reasons. So, the Florida governor has barred private businesses and is trying to impose upon cruise lines a prohibition against requiring vaccine before you get on a cruise or before you enter the business or other things like that. This is a mandate coming from a Republican governor against private companies, preventing them from exercising, their own belief that we would prefer to run a business that is safer by having people who have been vaccinated.
Right. No shoes, no shirt, no service.
Right? Exactly right. Yeah, no, he's not going to prohibit that.
Right. So just in the last couple of minutes then, Mark Fenster, as much as one doesn't want to demonize the anti-vaccine community and instead trying to find ways to educate them, nevertheless, some of the theories that are out there now that are getting a lot of... and first of all, there's an affluent suburb here in Los Angeles, the Pacific Palisades, and I was driving through there the other day and all the store windows had these stickers on that were the Soviet flag, the hammer and sickle. But instead of the hammer, there was a syringe. And so that was the message. And nothing, that was it. So it's not just uneducated people who resist it. It's obviously affluent, educated people. But one of the latest ones is the idea that vaccines will magnetize your body. And, there was a hearing in Ohio at the Cleveland Health Clinic there, and a doctor, Sherry Tenpenny, an osteopath. She's a leading anti-vaxxer. And one of the other ones is that's been out there for a while is that Bill Gates of Microsoft is behind a global scheme to secretly implant chips into you via the vaccine. So that he somehow can control billions of people. And there are a whole bunch of others. So what do you do about that? I mean, you obviously you have to refute this nonsense, don't you?
You do. It's they become so, baroque and bizarre that it's almost, difficult to refute insofar as like, well, Bill Gates is not, there are no microchips in the vaccine. We promise you that. At the same time that I would say, we don't want to impugn everyone with the idea that you're just a paranoid, crazy person, there are people who are, paranoid, crazy people who are, oftentimes the most vocal of the within this community. The only thing that you can do with them is to specifically, refute what it is that they're saying and reveal the extent to which it is based upon nothing other than some sort of bizarre fantasies. So you are specifically targeting the people who are the most vocal members of the anti-vax community, while respecting the fact that there are people who, somehow fall down the rabbit hole on the internet or with a, from hearing from a cousin or an uncle or a friend of theirs at work or something like that, respecting the fact that they have heard this, and not impugning their motivations, not impugning their intelligence, but attempting to rationally meet them where they are and find someone who can persuade them that it is in fact not true that, you know, that they will be magnetized as a result of getting these vaccines.
Well, you know, Elvis could be alive.
But, well, that would be a pretty good, that, you know, he'd be a little bit old now, but that would be one of those that wouldn't be so bad to be true.
You know, what's the alternative? You'd exhume his body? I mean, please, let him rest in peace, you know.
True.
Well, Mark, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I speak with Mark Fenster, who's a professor at the Levin College of Law at the University of Florida, whose research focuses on government transparency, legal intellectual history, and constitutional limits on government regulation. He's the author of The Transparency Fix, Secrets, Leaks, and Uncontrollable Government Information, and Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing